Imagine you run a startup.
Right, the dream.
Yeah, the dream. You've poured years of your life into this company.
Blood, sweat, tears, all of it.
Exactly. Everything is finally clicking, the market is responding, and then, you wake up one morning and get hit with a $100 million patent lawsuit from a massive competitor.
Which is just a total nightmare scenario.
Your company is essentially dead on arrival.
Yeah.
But instead of paying an army of lawyers to fight it out in court for the next decade, you just go out and buy a tiny, completely unrelated startup for $8 million.
Which is wild.
Right. This little company has zero revenue, but suddenly that $100 million existential threat completely vanishes.
You save your business.
You save your business. So today we are exploring how invisible legal force fields make that exact kind of corporate alchemy possible. Welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here. And that invisible force field is what we call intellectual property or IP. And it really is the underlying architecture that separates the companies that thrive from the ones that just get completely crushed.
Which brings us to our mission for you today. Because if you are starting a business, or if you're thinking about investing your hard-earned money into someone else's startup, IP usually feels like this terrifying, impenetrable legal
Oh,
minefield.
absolutely. People hear IP and their eyes glaze over.
Yeah, so we are going to demystify it. We want to extract the highly practical, real-world ways that startups actually use and often completely abuse intellectual property to build massive value.
Yes.
We're drawing all of this from the incredibly insightful piece of writing by Fred Cohen over at Angel to Exit.
Which is a huge deal. For some context, Angel to Exit is the largest incubator and accelerator in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, they really know their stuff.
They do. And the author makes a crucial disclaimer right at the start, which I think we should mirror here.
Oh, definitely.
He is speaking from decades of hard-won in the trenches business experience as an entrepreneur and an investor.
Right, he is not speaking as a lawyer.
Exactly, not a lawyer. We are looking at this entire topic through the lens of pure business strategy rather than, abstract legal theory.
Right. We're breaking down why mishandling this invisible foundation isn't just a legal oopsie, it's like a primary reason startups actually fail.
It really is.
So before you can magically turn IP into actual cash in the bank, you have to understand the raw materials you're working with.
The building blocks.
Right. The source breaks intellectual property down into five distinct categories.
Yeah.
So let's look at the mechanics of this architecture. And we have to start with the heavy hitter. Patents.
Ah, patents. They represent a really fascinating negotiation with the government.
How so?
Well, if you invent something genuinely novel, like a new method, a piece of hardware, a unique process, you can apply for a patent.
Okay.
And if the government grants it, you are handed 20 years, usually starting from your first filing date, of exclusive rights to make, use, or sell that invention. Yeah. It literally becomes a civil violation for anyone else in the country to infringe on your territory.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the government doesn't just hand out two-decade monopolies out of the goodness of its heart.
Right. They certainly do not.
So what is the actual cost here?
The price tag is total unredacted public disclosure.
Wait, really? Total disclosure?
Total. You have to announce to the entire world exactly how your invention
Oh,
works.
wow.
Yeah, you are legally required to explain your proprietary process in such excruciating detail that a competitor in your exact field could read your patent and replicate it.
Or I guess even figure out a way to slightly improve upon it.
Exactly. You are trading your secret know-how for a temporary, legally enforced monopoly.
So a patent is basically an extreme recipe exchange.
I like that.
Like you show the whole world your secret sauce, you publish the exact ingredients, but the government promises that nobody else is legally allowed to cook that meal for 20 years.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, these tools aren't just dry legal concepts. These are the literal barriers to entry in a market. By legally preventing your competitors from using your recipe, you create what investors call stickiness.
Stickiness. Okay.
Yeah, you lock in your market advantage because the customer literally has no choice but to come to you to get that specific result.
That makes total sense if you are building a physical machine. But what if your value is entirely in the code you wrote or the specific way you express an idea?
Right, like software.
Yeah. What if you absolutely do not want to publish your secret sauce to the world?
Well, that is where the second raw material comes into play, copyrights.
Okay.
Copyrights do not protect the underlying idea itself. They protect the original, tangible expression of that idea.
So what does that cover, practically?
This covers everything from like a painting or a novel to the actual source code of your software.
Oh, I see. So from a startup perspective, this is the legal shield that stops a lazy competitor from just copy-pasting your software code, slapping their logo on it, and launching a clone overnight.
Precisely. It limits the right of others to simply copy, sell, or publicly present your original work.
Got it.
Now, there is an exception for fair use, which allows the public to use small snippets of your work for things like academic quotes, parody, or news reporting.
Right.
But broadly speaking, it protects the literal artifact you created.
Okay, so we've covered the recipe and the code. Let's move to the vibe, like the reputation.
The brand.
Exactly. The third category is trademarks and trade names. And the author uses his own organization, Angel to Exit, as the prime example here.
Yeah, trademarks are the protective bubble around your brand's reputation.
Right.
Like, if another consulting firm tries to sell their services using the name Angel to Exit, they are essentially hijacking the trust, the goodwill, and the market recognition that the original company spent years building.
That makes sense. But the text highlights the mechanics of why some trademarks work and others fail.
It does. First, they have to be sufficiently unique. You cannot trademark a generic word like coffee.
Why is that? Mechanically, like, why not?
Because if the government let you trademark the word coffee, you could theoretically sue every cafe and grocery store on the planet for using it.
Oh, right. That would be chaos.
Complete chaos. The legal system doesn't allow you to monopolize everyday language. Your mark has to be distinctive to your specific goods or services in the mind of the consumer.
Okay, uniqueness. What's the second rule?
Second, the law requires you to actively enforce it and mark it consistently.
Ah, like with the little symbols.
Yeah, usually with that little TM or R symbol so the public is officially on notice.
And if you don't?
If you ignore people infringing on your trademark, you can actually lose the legal protection altogether.
Wow. We will definitely circle back to that enforcement piece because that sounds like a massive trap.
It is.
But let's look at the fourth option. Let's say you have an incredibly valuable recipe, but you don't want a patent because you refuse to show the public how you make it.
You go with trade secrets.
Right.
A trade secret is elegant in its simplicity. It is valuable business information that is legally protected simply by the fact that you keep it a heavily guarded secret.
Like the Coca-Cola formula.
The classic example. The source points exactly to that. It became an incredibly valuable asset because millions of people love the taste and nobody else in the world could reproduce it.
But I'm looking at the mechanics of this, and the risk seems massive.
How so?
Well, if Coca-Cola hired me and I accidentally tweeted out the recipe, they lose that protection forever. Right? There is no government monopoly backing you up like there is with a patent.
Exactly. The protection simply vanishes. A trade secret relies entirely on internal security and contracts.
You mean non-disclosure agreements? Yeah. NDAs.
Yes. Specifically NDAs. The government isn't protecting the secret itself. The courts are just enforcing the contract you made with your employees or partners to keep their mouths shut.
Right.
Once the secret is out in the wild, the contract doesn't bind the rest of the planet. Anyone can legally use it.
That is terrifying for a business owner.
It is. But the text points out an interesting historical note. While competitors eventually reverse engineered and formulated similar tasting drinks over the decades,
sure,
slightly diminishing the raw value of the Coca-Cola secret recipe, their trademark, that iconic brand name, remained incredibly powerful.
Ah, so they lean on the vibe when the secret gets figured out.
Exactly. It shows how these different types of IP have to work together to keep a company alive.
Which brings us to the final piece of the architecture, the plus one to the core four, third-party IP.
Yes. This is the intellectual property you essentially rent from someone else.
Rent? Like what?
Think about the underlying operating system your app runs on, or a highly specialized physical coding you use on your hardware product. You don't own it, but you sign an agreement and compensate the creator to use it. You are licensing their barrier to entry to build your own house.
Okay, so we have the raw materials, patents, copyrights, trademarks, trade secrets, and rented third-party IP.
That's the toolkit.
Understanding them is essential, but just holding on to a bunch of legal paperwork doesn't put money in the bank.
Sadly, no.
So how do you actually convert these abstract legal concepts into cold, hard cash? The source describes this as monetization, and the way it's laid out almost reads like a playbook for corporate alchemy.
Turning the heavy, burdensome weight of legal filings into gold.
Exactly.
Well, you spend immense capital, time, and engineering effort creating this IP, Monetization is the engine that makes that initial investment profitable.
I mean, the direct exchange of value is obvious. You write a piece of proprietary software, I pay you a monthly subscription fee to use it, or you license your patent to a manufacturer for a royalty.
Right, standard stuff.
But the author hints at ways to use IP offensively against competitors without even dragging them into a courtroom. How does that work mechanically?
Okay, so the author details a brilliant psychological and competitive strategy called deprecating competitors.
Deprecating competitors, okay.
Let's say a rival company is in the market claiming to have this incredibly complex, highly difficult capability, and they are charging a massive premium for it.
Like, this is hard, so you have to pay us a lot.
Exactly. You can use your IP to replicate a similar capability incredibly quickly and offer it for a fraction of the cost.
Wow. So you aren't just undercutting them on price. You are fundamentally undermining their entire business narrative.
You are weaponizing your efficiency. By offering the same result cheaply and easily, you prove to the entire market that your rival is overcharging.
You completely trivialize their value proposition.
Yes. Customers realize the competitor isn't actually that special, and you use your IP to demonstrate that you are the modern, efficient choice.
That is wonderfully ruthless.
It really is.
And the text introduces the flip side of that coin, too, which it calls meeting or exceeding expectations.
Yes. In this scenario, you don't undercut the competitor's price at all.
Yeah.
If the market rate for a specific professional service is $15,000, you charge exactly $15,000.
Keep the price the same.
Right. But behind the scenes, you deploy your IP. Maybe it's a proprietary internal AI tool or a secret automated workflow to do the job in a tenth of the time and deliver a vastly superior result.
So the customer just thinks you are brilliant and providing a premium service. They have no idea a machine is doing the heavy lifting.
The customer pays the market rate and is thrilled with the fast result. But because your IP dramatically lowered your internal cost to deliver that service, your profit margins become wildly higher than anyone else in the industry.
Oh, that's smart.
Your competitor is spending 100 hours of human labor to earn that 15 grand. You are spending 10 hours. Your IP is secretly generating a massive cash advantage.
I love the mechanics of that. I also want to touch on the sheer power of brand longevity through trademarks, because the text uses an example that everyone can relate to.
Yes, the rock band example.
Right.
The author uses the example of a legacy rock band to show how brand value can completely detach from the original product.
How so?
Well, long after the original music stops being written, or the founding members of a band retire, quit, or pass away, the trademark name lingers in the culture.
Oh, totally. People will continue to pay hundreds of dollars for concert tickets simply because of their emotional connection to the brand name on the marquee.
Exactly. Even if the musicians on stage are entirely different people who just acquired the rights to the name, the trademark literally outlives the creators.
I completely buy that. But I have to push back on a claim in the text regarding investors.
Okay, let's hear it.
The author suggests you can secure funding just by appearing to have valuable IP, even if the patent itself is incredibly weak.
He does say that.
Wait, so you're telling me you can make money just by looking like you have valuable IP? I have to stop you there. Investors aren't stupid. These are sophisticated venture capital firms managing billions of dollars.
Very true.
Why on earth would they hand over real money based on a crappy patent they haven't even read, knowing it might get thrown out by a judge on day one?
What's fascinating here is understanding the psychology of perceived value in the venture capital world.
Right?
Investors revere IP, but they are also incredibly busy, and they often lack the deep, hyper-niche technical expertise of the founders they are funding.
Right. They can't be experts in everything.
Exactly. The text points out that merely having a patent applied for acts as a massive signal of competence to the outside world.
So it's not about the technical merits of the patent claims.
Right.
It's about what the paperwork represents about the founder's mindset.
It demonstrates that you are sophisticated enough to play the corporate game. You have the discipline to document your process, hire a lawyer, and navigate the patent office. When an investor is looking at two competing startups, and yours has a patent pending stamp, and the other is just a pitch deck, they will often choose to fund you.
That is wild.
The patent isn't actually protecting the technology in that specific moment. It's acting as a shiny lure. It's an illusion of value that creates real-world financial backing.
The legal force field doesn't even have to be turned on yet. It just has to look intimidating.
Exactly. And while impressing investors is crucial for keeping a startup alive in the early days, the ultimate payoff for accumulating all these IP chess pieces happens at the very end of a company's life cycle.
Let's get into that end game.
Yeah.
Section 3, the ultimate checkmate. When we talk about exit value, we are talking about the moment a startup achieves the dream, right? Getting acquired by a bigger fish.
Right. Large corporations acquire smaller companies for two broad categories of reasons, financial and strategic.
Okay, break that down.
Financially, a big company might buy your startup because they can take your niche product, push it through their massive global distribution channels, and instantly multiply the revenue. It's a pure math play.
Right. But the strategic reasons are where the IP portfolio really flexes its muscles, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. A giant tech conglomerate might buy you because they desperately want to enter your specific market.
And buying your proven patented IP is way faster and carries far less uncertainty than trying to invent a competing technology from scratch.
Exactly. But the most compelling strategic reason to acquire a company, and this brings us back to the scenario you painted at the very beginning of our deep dive.
Oh, the lawsuit. Here's where it gets really interesting. I want to walk through the mechanics of that high-stakes corporate battlefield from the text.
The company A, B, and C scenario.
Yeah, set the stage for us.
Imagine two massive competitors. Company A files a massive patent infringement lawsuit against Company B. Company A claims that Company B's core product is violating their patents. If Company B loses this lawsuit, they are looking at a devastating $100 million penalty. It is an existential threat.
$100 million. I mean, most companies would just fold, or they would buckle down, hire a skyscraper full of lawyers, and spend the next 5 years draining their account trying to fight Company A in court.
That is the traditional route.
Right.
But instead, the executives at Company B look at the broader chessboard, they start scanning the market, and they find Company C.
And who's Company C?
Company C is a small, completely unrelated startup. They have almost no market share and barely any revenue. But Company C holds a very specific, obscure set of patents.
Let me guess, patents that Company A is actually infringing upon.
Yes, in a totally different part of their business.
Wow. So Company B doesn't try to license the patents from the startup. They just outright buy Company C.
They just buy them. The text notes, they acquire them for $8 million.
Unbelievable.
Not for their customer list, not for their brilliant engineers, but strictly to acquire those specific patent documents.
And then what happens?
Well, the ink dries on the $8 million acquisition. Suddenly, Company B turns around to Company A and says, "You're suing us for $100 million. Well, we now own the patents that prove you are infringing on us, so we are countersuing you."
That is amazing. How does a standoff like that actually resolve?
It results in mutually assured destruction. Neither company wants to risk a jury trial anymore, so they settle. They agree to cross-license their patents.
What does cross-licensing mean in plain English for the listener?
It is essentially a legal ceasefire. Company A tells Company B, "You can use our patents for free if we can use yours for free."
Wow.
The massive lawsuit is dropped. They maybe pay $10 million each in legal fees to wrap up the paperwork. But look at the math. Company B was staring down a $100 million loss.
Yeah.
By strategically purchasing Company C for $8 million, they completely neutralized the threat. The author calls it a bargain.
A massive bargain. The math speaks for itself. But think about the founders of Company C for a second.
Oh, I know.
Their entire exit strategy, their life-changing $8 million payout, had absolutely nothing to do with how good their product was or how many users they had.
Nope.
It was based purely on holding the right IP chess pieces at the exact right moment someone else needed a shield. It is absolute high-stakes corporate chess.
It is incredible when it works. But, you know, this brings us to a harsh reality check.
Right.
If IP is genuinely this powerful, if it can save companies $100 million and trigger massive acquisitions, why do most startup founders completely mess it up?
Good question. Let's break down Fred Cohen's reality check. He advocates for what he calls a mixed strategy, balancing all these different types of IP.
Right.
But his decades of actual on-the-ground experience show that founders make predictable, fatal mistakes.
Huh.
Starting with patents. The theory sounds great, but he calls the actual process a grind.
A total grind. The reality of getting a good patent is vastly expensive and takes years of agonizing back and forth with examiners.
Yeah.
He notes that while his organization has ultimately made a net profit on patents over the decades, if he accounted for the sheer number of hours he spent agonizing over the paperwork, the return on investment might barely break even.
Ouch.
Yeah. Startups fail here because they either don't file the paperwork properly, leaving loopholes, or they waste precious early stage capital filing ridiculous worthless patents just to show off to funders.
Meanwhile, copyrights are the exact opposite experience. He describes them as essentially a missed open goal for startups.
Copyrights are incredibly simple and cost almost nothing to establish.
Right. You literally just have to religiously mark your documents, your code, and your designs with the copyright symbol and the year.
Exactly. The author notes he marks absolutely everything he produces, and it keeps his baseline value and reputation secure with virtually zero effort or cost.
It's free.
Yes. Yet he constantly sees founders failing to do this basic free step, which is a massive unforced error.
And what about the reality of trademarks?
We touched on this earlier. They are relatively cheap and easy to file, but they require relentless discipline.
Because of the enforcement thing.
Exactly. A trademark is completely useless if you don't actively monitor your industry, enforce your rights, and consistently send cease and desist notices to anyone who infringes.
It's a use it or lose it system.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If a founder lets competitors slowly start using their trademark without challenging them in writing, the legal protection just evaporates.
Okay, let's talk about the reality of trade secrets. Because this is where startups seem to completely lose their minds.
Yes.
From what the text describes, it sounds like founders treat non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs, like confetti at a parade.
They really do. The author expresses a very real, palpable frustration with this exact behavior. Founders wildly overuse NDAs.
So if you are listening to this right now and you are about to send a dense 20-page NDA to a potential partner just to pitch them a high-level idea over coffee, the author is basically screaming at you to stop.
Please stop, because you are actually diluting the legal power of your real trade secrets.
How does that happen?
Startups will demand you sign a massive legal document to protect information that is either already common industry knowledge or will inevitably be public very soon anyway.
Right.
A trade secret is only legally valid in court if it is an actual secret that provides actual economic value.
Which makes sense.
If you treat every mundane email and high-level concept as a top-secret classified document, a judge will eventually look at your NDA and rule that it is entirely unenforceable.
Yeah, he even mentions he outright refuses to sign NDAs for information that shouldn't be secret in the first place.
And navigating all of these realities, you know, knowing when to burn cash on a patent, when to just use a free copyright mark, having the discipline to enforce a trademark, and knowing how to properly narrow the scope of an NDA, it requires real business maturity.
It's not for amateurs.
No. It requires bringing in actual specialized IP lawyers early in the process to build a custom strategy, rather than trying to DIY your legal foundation with templates you found on the internet.
So what does this all mean? If we pull all these threads together, intellectual property isn't just the boring legal paperwork you pay a lawyer to file and then forget in a drawer.
Far from it.
It is the active living barrier that protects your market share. It is the shiny illusion of perceived value that gets you in the door with sophisticated investors.
Yep.
And as we saw with Company C, it's a strategic weapon that might one day trigger a massive life-changing acquisition just because you are holding the right shield at the right time.
Well said. And if we pull back to the big picture, this raises an important philosophical question, and it's something I think we should leave the listener lingering on today.
I'd love to hear it.
We discussed how a legacy band can keep selling out massive stadium arenas using just the psychological power of a trademark long after every single original member who actually wrote the music is gone.
Yeah, that blew my mind.
Yeah.
And we discussed how venture capitalists will confidently hand over millions of dollars to fund a startup based on a crappy patent they haven't even bothered to read just because the paperwork exists.
Right. So we have to ask ourselves, in the modern hyper-competitive economy, is the ultimate value of a business really built on the actual tangible quality of its original ideas?
Or
is the true value merely built on the strength of the legal force field it constructs around the illusion of those ideas?
Wow. That is the $1 million or maybe the $8 million question.
Exactly.
If you want to explore these concepts further with the folks over at Angel to Exit, the text does mention they host a free monthly advisory call.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah. It is typically held on the first and third Thursday of the month at VO 900 Pacific time. You can actually pitch your own company situation and learn from other founders who are navigating this exact invisible fortress.
It's a great resource.
It really is. Until then, remember that the walls you can't see are often the only ones keeping your business standing. Keep digging and stay curious.